Winspiration, the way to the essential. On UK Health Radio, Winspiration brings wisdom and information for an extraordinary future. Together, we can shape the world we want to live in. So let's get real and create the idea. Be extraordinary. Welcome to another Winspiration episode. Today, it might give you goosebumps. We have an extremely special guest. For me, the person shows me what humans can really experience. So big highs and extremely lows. Love, hate, everything. And how do we get to know a person like this? Yeah, sometimes universe takes care. Recently, we had here Leslie Downey, who wrote the book Letters to Men. Incredible stories in there, and the story of this man we have here today. Remember, you can buy this book on every online store. But coming now to the guest of the day, it's Mark Peters. And in Leslie's book, we find a little introduction, and it helps me. Otherwise, maybe it would take an hour to explain this incredible guy. I am an international motivational speaker, raconteur, war journalist, photographer based in Cape Town. I work for the Johannesburg Star, the New York Times, LA Times, London Sunday Times, Chicago Tribune, and finally Newsweek magazine. I covered numerous wars, 16 wars, from Rhodesia to Afghanistan, and I've been sentenced to death 3 times in the line of his life. This is just some of his life. There's so many stories that it's hard to choose which to talk today about it. When he was 9 years, he chose to live or sleep on a cemetery and asked, "Why are you doing this?" He said, "I want to overcome fear in my life." This is an interesting topic to talk about. And he showed that he really had situations where he didn't experience the fear, he overcame it. And what we love at Winspiration, he says everybody has a special gift to bring into life. And today we want to talk with Mark Peters.
Thank you.
Very welcome here about your wonderful stories. And we have in the back the photo of Mandela. Mark, you were invited to
Mr. Mandela
his house,
invited me to his house.
Have lunch there.
Have lunch.
Yeah.
And I was making my way to get, it was a buffet, to get a plate of food. And the band leader came to me and said, "Won't you sit next to Mr. Mandela? I can see you're having a good time with him. He's friends with you. Would you ask him to come and play the marimba?"
Yeah.
So, you know, I just love this picture because it's at his house and it's happiness. And it's freedom, you know, it's just all there. I just love that picture.
And it's interesting also, his life, the 27 years in prison and what came out of it. And most people don't know this photo for sure, but the other one I just printed out, we have it here in a bigger way also, where Mandela just came out of prison.
That was a big day, actually.
That was a big day. If you just maybe share a little bit the story. How was it possible? Because this is already an extraordinary lesson that you could do this photo.
I've just done a decade of covering violence in South Africa. I've been probably into every township there is in this country. And then F.W. de Klerk, the then president, announced that Nelson Mandela will quite rapidly actually be coming out of prison in a week's time. And, of course, the whole world's press decided, you've got to be there for Nelson Mandela. Newsweek, I work for Newsweek. Unfortunately for Newsweek, Mandela was coming out on a Sunday because we go to bed on a Saturday night. Newsweek time, we were magazines, weekly magazines. So Newsweek decided what they would do is they would hold the presses for the second time in their life, in the history. And the first time, I believe, was the end of the Second World War. And the second time, which is the release of Nelson Mandela. They had put the magazine to bed. They just needed the cover. You can imagine the pressure I had on me. But they eased it by saying, "We'll take the first wire service picture because it's going to cost money holding the presses." Anyway, the night before, I was staying down the road about a half an hour away from the prison. And I met my old editor, Harvey Tyson, from the Star newspaper, and we had far too many beers. And I woke up, I told the hotel to wake me up at about 8 because Mandela was coming out at 10. And I woke up at 11 and I realized I've missed the biggest story. Oh, I spent a whole decade looking for this picture. You know, I put the TV on and I saw Mandela still there. So I had a quick shower. I jumped into Auntie Avis's car. James E. Bondi did it 100 miles an hour to the prison. And just as I got to the prison, there's a roadblock. And I saw this Italian crew walking by, four of them. And I love Italians. They were shouting at each other. They weren't allowed to go. They weren't allowed to go through. So I went up to this white cop and I said to him, I'm a South African. Can I go through? He said, no. Strict orders. There's absolutely strict orders that no one else is allowed to go. It's only a half a K down the road. All of the benches are just packed. There's helicopters with cameras sticking out of them. And there's a small group in the front with the gate. And we're not allowed anybody else. So I stuck my hand out and said, congratulations, you won the war. And he said, what war? I said, the war between you and I. I photographed you chasing, shooting, chasing, killing blacks, forcibly removing, doing your apartheid thing. You, on the other hand, have beaten me up, thrown me in jail, smashed my camera, confiscated my film. But the worst thing you did to me was you blew up my brand new Mazda 66. I had it for 3 days. And that cheesed me off. And I'm still cheesed off about that. And he said, what's your name? I said, Mark Peters. And he said, you see that yellow van over there? I said, yeah. He said, it's just come over the police radio that he'll be walking out in 10 to 15 minutes. Why don't you and I jump in that van and go witness history? So, wow, I thought, fantastic. You know, so I jump in the van. We get to the spot. I see all the press on they're all on the other side of the road. And I don't want to get out of. I tell the cop to go right up to where the boom is, and which he does do. And I see Cyril Ramaphosa, who I've known for over 40 years, is standing there, and he's looking at me because I'm in the front of a police van. And I know his expression is saying, have you been a cop all these years? I'm used to you being in the back of the police van, but not in the front. But I couldn't get out to tell him that. And then eventually Mandela and his group started. I saw this group in the distance getting bigger and bigger. And that was the first visuals that I had. And as Mandela went through the boom, and he took his first steps, where the statue is now, which is based on my photograph, it was the moment that I captured that historic photograph. Because then I jumped out, and you shoot a special format for the cover, which I did. I didn't hang around. I just went to Cape Town. I went to the Associated Press, and I said, and there was Reuters, Agence Press. They were all waiting for their photographers. They hadn't arrived. They all got caught up in the moment. It was a big mistake on their behalf because there was also traffic jams. But anyway, I got there, and I said to Associated Press, I processed the film. I saw I had that image, and I said, I'll give it to you on one condition, that you send it to New York now, to Newsweek. Magazine's out. That means no magazine in the world can use it for a week because they're holding the press. And he said, done. So I phoned New York, and I said, it's coming through. It's a cover. Associated Press had, I think, 90% of the world's first editions on their front pages in the newspapers. And Newsweek was the first magazine in the world to have Mandela on the cover. And we printed 4 million copies that week. And once the picture had gone, Newsweek phoned me back, and they said, hang on, we've got someone who wants to talk to you. So I thought it would be the editor-in-chief or anything, but it wasn't. It was the original version, not, I can't remember the woman's name who sang it, but it was a song, and it was just, you're simply the best, better than all the rest. And that really made it for me, because, you know, there's so many foreigners that are just coming here and thought they could just get that picture. You know, they hadn't even been into a township.
And simply the best is really something. It's not only for this moment. You have more than 25 covers on Newsweek.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're really one of the superstars in
the photography industry. But after Mandela's release, you know, I thought, well, what's happening now? You know, is it going to run out of time? Are Newsweek still going to need me? But then they did need me, and then they sent me to cover wars.
Let's a moment stay with Mandela. You saw him coming out, made a photo, but you didn't have personal contact. So when was the first contact, and what made it that he later invited you to
I knew Zinzi's daughter, and every now and again I'd give her a photograph. I'd photograph her so she could take it to her dad.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, just by covering him constantly, being in his presence, we kind of got on well. You know, he was a nice guy to me. And we went to Robben Island. He took 40 journalists. He was going to go and see Sal for the first time. So we've got 20 local, 20 foreign, and he's already on the island. So we're all standing around. And press can be really out of control at times. And we didn't know who was going to be the first person he'd choose.
Mm-hmm.
But he walked straight up to me and he said to me, how are you? And I said, I'm fine. And then he said to me, do you remember me? And I said, sorry, what's your name again? And he put his arm around me, he said, come on. And
yeah.
I was the first person he took into his cell, which is, I got a much better picture outside in the courtyard, actually, where he's.
Yeah.
They spend a lot of their time.
Well, that's something typically for you as well. And when we recently had a conversation and we had a friend there from Scotland, says, typical Scots people. Yeah, and you have
Scottish blood in me. Yeah.
Yes. And if it's Mandela, what is your name? And no shyness, nothing. There's special respect, but.
You got to keep the respect. I mean, I'll come back to that with Maggie Thatcher, with Bush in the Oval Office, actually.
Yes, when you were with Mandela, you flew with Mandela.
So then after that,
New York,
we flew to New York.
Yes.
And we went down to Port Authority, which is on the bottom of Manhattan. We're going up, I think, the Avenues of America on a ticket parade. And I was just looking at this Popemobile and wondering, And then I just tap on my shoulder, and it's Mr. Mandela. And he said, Mark, I want you on that van behind us. And I said, that's Secret Service. They're not going to allow it. And so he said, come with me. And then the Secret Service said, Mr. Mandela, you want this man on the van? It's a done deal. And there wasn't much I could do because Woody and Mandela were their backs were to me. But it was an incredible experience. You know, I'm just a little boy I started a career in Bulawayo, in a landlocked country in Africa, you know. And now I'm going on a ticket parade. So I was waving away, having a wonderful time. I saw some mates. It was like, it's my jewel. You know, I was having the best time of my life. And then afterwards, we got on the plane and we flew to Washington. That evening, we got to Washington because the next morning, we were going to go to meet the President of the United States, Bush. So I got into my hotel room and the first thing I did is put the TV on. I hadn't eaten the whole day. I was pumped. You know, I'd just been on a ticket parade. So I phoned room service, triple whiskey, double hamburger. And then I looked at the TV and the first thing I saw was myself going, how's that? Who's that? Whoa. Yeah. And it kept coming back to me. It was getting a bit embarrassing. And then the phone rang and I thought it was room service on an unusual order. And it was, hello, is that you, Mark? And I said, it is, Mr. Mandela. And he says, are you watching TV in a serious voice? And I said, yeah. And then he waited a while, and then he started getting, he says, I see you enjoyed your ticket parade. And that's the kind of man he was. You know, he made sure that I was there and had a good time.
It was really an incredible lesson of leadership.
Yeah, human kindness is that man. Is an incredible human being.
Yeah, in Washington, meeting next day the president.
Yeah, the next day we go, Newsweek got ordered, organized that I could go in 20 minutes before Mandela arrived. So I got to the Oval Office and the chief of staff, not the nicest human being, you know, he said to me, when you go in, you go in, the president's going to be sitting at the Oval desk. And I said, Abe's desk, still Abe Lincoln's desk. I just informed him that I knew a little bit. And he said, you take your pictures and then you come out and you sit here. And when Mr. Mandela comes, you and Mr. Mandela can walk in to meet the president. But under no condition do you speak to the President of the United States. I thought, okay. So I walk into the Oval Office, not as big as I think it is. And I see Bush, he's sitting at the office. But there's this beam of light coming in from the Rose Garden. And it's on the front of the desk and it dissipates, light goes away quickly. So I walked up to him and I said, Mr. President, I beg your pardon, but I know I'm not allowed to talk to you, but there's this beam of light. Would you mind getting up and just sitting on the corner of the desk? And I felt the vibes coming from me, from the chief of staff and the two security guards. And Bush looked at me and he said, boy, what's it like to tell the most powerful man in the world to move? So I looked at him and he was smiling because he was known to crack jokes. So I smiled at him and I said, Mr. President, we all have our moments of glory, sir. Do you mind putting your butt on the edge of the table? And he laughed. And butt's an English word, by the way. So I'm allowed to say that. Anyway, afterwards, I did my pictures and I went and sat. And then Mr. Mandela arrived. And Mandela and I then walked into the Oval Office to meet the president formally. And it was actually another experience that I had because we went out of at the back of the office into the Rose Garden. And about 200 yards away, there was this roped area of just hundreds of press. And it was just for me. And there's three of us walking towards it. There's one is the most powerful man in the world, the President of the United States. The other is the most loved man in the world. And who's that other jerk standing next to them? You know? Me. You know? So it's kind of cool. But then I went back to the hotel. We were going to go to LA the next day. And I came back and it was just a whole lot of messages. Yeah, you're off the tour. I'll come back to New York. The president wants to see you. So I phoned my boss. He said, you're going to get fired. You can't tell the president of the United States to move his butt in his office. So I thought, okay, that's life. So I went back and I saw Rick Smith, a wonderful man, great editor, great journalist, great leader. And he said, look, Mark, they want you to – I spent the whole night with these guys. They want you fired. And I said, I'm not under any circumstances going to fire you. And we've now made a decision. There's an intifada happening in Israel. You go do what you do best. You go to Israel, and you're off the tour. And as long as I was off the tour, that was fine. But you know, to fire someone for saying something like that is just an abuse of power, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah. I mean, I may have been married and had kids and everything, just took my job away. Well, what?
Yeah, what is maybe the American way of
but life? I said to him, was it because I told the president of the United States to move his butt? And he said, no, he instigated that. Mm-hmm. You broke protocol. Mm-hmm. You weren't allowed to talk to him. And so they took that seriously.
Yeah.
That's my story with Bush.
It shows just one more how you can handle the situation, no fear. You couldn't go to Hollywood, as you said.
I had visions of never coming back. I was going to be like
me. Incredible.
I was going to become a star in Hollywood. That's what I wanted to
do. Yeah.
But,
who got the photo of the light? Yeah, and the president moving there and just...
Yeah, no, he was a great guy.
Like you said, how did it feel to tell the president to move?
Yeah.
But there's also, I know you had a kind of backup from the Washington Post owner.
Mrs. Graham. Graham, she came out a couple of years before, and she came to Cape Town, and we spent a week with her, the Washington Post correspondent, Newsweek correspondent, and myself. And we took her to the airport, and she was getting on the jet, private jet. And we said goodbye to her. And we were walking back into the terminal. And then a policeman ran up and said, who's Mark Peters? And I said, it's me. She said, Mrs. Graham would like to talk to you. And at that stage, Mrs. Graham is probably the most powerful woman in the world. And so I went back and I said, Mrs. Graham, is there a problem? And she said, she spoke like this. She said, no, honey, I just want you to know that as long as I own the Washington Post Company, which owns Newsweek, you will always have a job. And I'll tell the president of Newsweek that. So I knew that he couldn't fire me. You know? Well, Kay wouldn't allow him to fire me.
Yeah, because you're simply the best.
Better than all the rest.
Fire the best in this.
But that's how you handle it. I mean, I'll jump ahead. I mean, I went to photograph Maggie Thatcher, and it was raining.
Yeah,
and she was so nice, and she was probably the most powerful woman, in England anyway, but in the world she was.
Yeah,
and it was raining. I mean, she was pushing the chair around, and I said, "No, I'm not going to use the flash. It has to be available light. It's just not nice." So she said, "Okay, come. In Parliament there's a park. There. We'll seal it off tomorrow because it's good weather. And we'll do that." And she said, "Would you like a cup of tea?" I said, "Love it." So we go in the kitchen. She's making me tea. She's making cheese and tomato and cucumber sandwiches and having a cup of tea. I mean, I'm just talking to her like it's my mom.
Yeah.
You know, and she's just gone so well. You know, I've never been fazed by people who hold a status that are higher than me.
But not only the people, but the situations.
The situation.
Were even, I would say, a little bit more stressful. But before we come to that, and now we talked already, like, the three people in the back of the White House, what incredible position there is. But it was not always like this, that you were this superhero and Newsweek. You spent also in former times and a year on the Table Mountain.
I was 22 years old. There was a war going on in my country, Rhodesia. I was tired of being a soldier. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I had a friend of mine who, most of my friends were just about to finish university. And, you know, I'm 23. I don't know what I'm going to do. So I just picked up my rucksack up and I hitchhiked to Cape Town. In fact, I didn't even go to the border post. I just crossed over the Limpopo River. And I eventually came to Cape Town. It took about 4 or 5 days to get to Cape Town. And I was at Mooli Point and it was getting dark and I looked for a friendly face. I said, first thing you do when you come from a landlocked country is you go to the beach. And I saw this guy, he had a nice face. I said to him, excuse me, can you tell me if there's a caravan park or somewhere I was going to sleep there? And his expression changed and he said, do I look like I sell property? You know, you bloody hippie, go live on the mountain. So I looked at the mountain, I said, cool. So I went up, I got to the mountain, and found myself a place in the mountain, and I eventually stayed in that spot for nearly a year.
Yeah.
And it was great because I had this slab of rock, and there was a gully down with water, and then there was a similar rock on the other side, and there was a puff adder lived there. And for days, I'd just look at Puffy, and we'd look at each other. You know, you can't ever outslayer a snake. But it was great. It was, you know, those days, non-whites had to be out of the city by 6 o'clock. I mean, you could do something like that now. Mm-hmm. You know, you could. But eventually, I decided I needed to get home.
What was the biggest lesson for this year up there?
Just actually, the lesson there was survival for me. You know, mm-hmm. just to, you know, I mean, I didn't know this, but in 6 years' time, I'd be living down the road at the Mount Nelson in the suite. You know, and I always remember that's when the lesson really comes to me, that everything you've got can go away in one day. You know? It can all change. Your life can change. And my life has changed now. You know, I've had a wine farm. I've owned 2 farms. I've had homes, Herbert Baker home. And, you know, I lost basically everything with COVID, my job. It was tough times. And it's not just me. There's a whole world of people out there. Mm-hmm. For me, I've been down at the bottom where the bad men live. I've been there. I can handle it. And they're decent people.
It sounds a little bit tough being on the mountain.
The mountain was great.
Yeah, for you was it great, but for a lot of people, I think.
No, I don't think a lot of people could do that. So, I was a tracker in the Indonesian army. I lived in the bush. I knew how to handle the bush. The bush for me was a wonderful experience.
But compared to other situations in your life, it was just like milk and honey on the Table Mountain. Yeah, Before we come to some war stories, just let's give us a short break for
sure.
A little
bit. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Apples and pears, beef and skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden. Ant and Deck, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries and cream.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
So, like I mentioned, you had really, really tough times, 3 times sentenced to death, and being also always the best in front row of war, having people being killed left and right on your side. This is
What was your
most extreme situation?
Well, I've had so many. I mean, I've been in gun battles in Mogadishu. The first Gulf War, I was with Special Forces, with America's highest decorated living soldier, Colonel David Ackworth. We got bombed by our own people. We were way ahead. We were the forward troops, and if the Iraqis made a move, The army was 20 miles behind. Mm-hmm. We would notify them. But I can tell you about in South Africa, I saw the very first necklace. They say the first necklace was a white policeman. And that's what wasn't put on record. But I was down in Port Elizabeth in about 84, 85 when Kinney, who was a town councillor and a funeral parlor owner. And the call was to kill anybody who worked for the system, otherwise the government. And they chased Kinney. He had his two sons with him and a son's friend. They ran into the parlor. And I was there with a friend of mine, Alan Cal from New York Times. And he shot both his sons and the son's friend. And then he went out and shot into the crowd. And then they got him. And that was then they beat him up, stabbed him, stoned him. And then they put a tie over him so he couldn't move his arms. So he was sitting up, and then they pulled petrol out of him. And he died this sort of macabre death, like freedom, fist in the air. And a couple of years later, probably a couple of months later, I'm in my office in Johannesburg, and a black friend of mine says to me, there's school boycotts going on, and all the journalists are out doing stories, but he's just got a phone call. He was from CBS News, and he said there's Orlando West High School. They've taken over the school, the kids, and it's on a Vilakazi Street opposite Nelson Mandela's house. So that rang a bell with me. It put some newsworthy sense into me going. So I went with him. And we got to Vilakazi Street, and we drove into the school, and guy opened the gates, old Abdullah opened the gates, he closed the gates, and as we got into the gates, we were just surrounded by agitated 15 to 25-year-olds. And Mishika, he was the black guy, said, Mish, go and sort this out. And he got out the car, and I looked, and he disappeared, and his head popped up, and he was down again. They were just beating him up, and then they took him into the school. I remember he always smiled, and I remember looking over his shoulder, and it's the only time I've ever seen Mishnah smile. Then I got out of the car, and I swung my camera back behind me and leant against the car.
Why went you out of the car? Couldn't you drive away?
Or? No, we couldn't. They surrounded us, and Mish made a mistake there. He was new to the game. First of all, you're in a situation like that. Wherever you are, you always reverse. You always get your car pointed to go. Anyway, it was too late. So I remember the crowd came to me, and there were three rather plump women in uniform. And the first one slapped me, and then the other two spat in my face. And then someone threw a rock and whacked me on my head, and blood started coming down. And then there was a call to stop. And then this guy came walking through the crowd. They parted ways. And he was tall, and he had an afro. And I thought, well, maybe I could talk to this guy. And I came up and I said to him, we're journalists. And hey, man, you even look a bit like Jimi Hendrix, man. You know, sort of throw something and give him one. First thing he did was punch me straight in the face. Wow. And he said, today you die, you white bastard. So I said, well, hey, come on, man, I'm like a journalist. And he punched me again. And then and then he turned around and he shouted something in Zulu to go and get the tire and the petrol. And I understood that. And I knew what was coming. And then, of course, the crowd were excited about this. You know, we were just, we kind of like...
You better explain this with the tire and the petrol.
They're going to go get the petrol and the tire, necklace.
And they put it over to me.
Yeah.
Or well, you can't move the arms.
I'd seen it first. I knew what was coming my way.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, he kept his back to me, and then it was about a minute, and then a guy came rolling the tire down and coming towards me, and behind him, with his hand up in the air and with a milk bottle filled with petrol, was his accomplice. And I knew then that I probably got about a minute left to live, or before they start beating me up. But what they didn't know is that I'm not the kind of guy he's just going to buckle down. I don't think there were many journalists that would have done what I just about to tell you.
For sure.
And I put my hand in my camera bag because they were all looking. And Jimi Hendrix, as I referred to him in my story that I've written, was facing back. I've got his back of his head. And I pulled my equalizer out, which is a 6-inch hunting knife, because I'm not the kind of guy that you're going to try and take my equipment with me without a fight. And I've gripped him by his hair. And I swung the knife around, but only intended of putting him there. But he felt the cold steel of revenge. And he went forward, but the crowd was coming this way. And then it just sprayed blood everywhere. He got cut. And then I said to him, I mean, I'm not going to use vulgar language on this, I'm sure. But I said to him, if I die today, you die. And on the way to heaven, I'll kill you again. I don't know where that came from. And then I spray painted my way out of there with Jimi Hendrix. And the old Madala opened the gate. And of course, everyone was stunned by this. And then I looked right and I just saw more black people running. There he is. I looked at Mandela's house, but I'd locked the gate. And I had the keys. I threw it into Mandela's house over the wall. And then I looked right and there was a guy in a sports car looking over his shoulder. And I thought, no, I can't believe this. But Jimmy was now losing a lot of blood. So I dropped him and I ran to this guy. And I just prayed he didn't start. And I jumped in the car and I said, drive. But my fear level was probably about 6. After 8, you'll never come back. I never went up. I wasn't scared of the situation there because I knew it would go down bloody. And I mean, I jumped in. I said, drive. And he said, certainly. He said it in a sort of English accent. And he said, where are you going? I said, Joburg. So he said, meet you, old chap. And we drove off. And we drove for a while. And then I realized I still had my knife pointing at him. And I said, sorry, I'm Mark Peters from Newsweek. And he said, I'm Trevor Tutu from... that's Bishop Tutu. And it dawned on me that both Tutu and Mandela, both Nobel laureates, basically live on Vilagazi Street. It's just weird. They're block apart from each other. Anyway, I thanked Trevor. He said, I thought he was a really, really nice guy. So I took him to a pub in Johannesburg where it was normal to see a journalist interviewing a black person. And we had a good lunch and a few beers. And I walked into his car, and as he's about his driveway, he looked at me and he said, Mark Peters, you're going to be famous or infamous one day. And I said to him, why? He says, you're probably the only white guy ever to hijack a concert with her. And I probably still hold that title. You know? But that is fear. You know, you can fear if you... I go to the townships, I work on my own. Well, I go with a few select journalists that I can work with. Otherwise, you see these little pods of journalists all going together. And they basically, they're diluting their fear by going with other people. You know, and that's not the way I work. If you're going to get something really good, 99% of the time, you're going to get your what you're looking for. You know, and why go with 4 other photographers?
It's also interesting, as you said, with the knife. I wanted to protect my photo equipment, and I said. Today we have no clue, I guess, anymore what kind of life as a photographer you were living. We have iPhones or whatever, smartphones.
Oh, yeah, that's instantaneous.
And everything, and then you can look, is it a good photo and everything? But just imagine you in the middle of the war, like your LSD focus.
And lens situation and distance.
And left and right. And you're so concentrated on making a photo. But at that time, you had films. So you couldn't check.
Especially in Africa, you know. During the genocide, the genocide was another game altogether, the Rwandan genocide. I mean, I got there, I booked into a Bill Killeen hotel, and they were still hacking each other to death in the streets. Mm-hmm. So I went in with the driver, and we went into the town, and I saw them hacking people, and I was trying to get a long lens. And then I saw 3 of Mother Teresa's order go, running by, and nuns don't run. They run like ducks, like this. So they don't stride out, but they were panicked for them. So I told the driver, I could see they were chasing the nuns. I said, go pick him up. And he said, no, he's not going to go. So I threw him out the car, and I drove to where the nuns were. And I caught up to them, and I said, get in the car. But they were stunned. So I had to then throw each one into the car. And then we just made it, because we took some pangas in the back of the, at the back of the boot. And then I took the nuns to where they were staying in the school with orphans. That moment, it was just, to me, because I'd spent some time with Mother Teresa, and I liked Mother Teresa. Mm-hmm. We were in a church. Anyway, I saved them. They were okay. But I'll give you a tell of Mother Teresa. First time I met her, we were in a church garden, and she was holding my hand, and we were just talking about love and kindness and how God told her when 2 hours out of Calcutta, get on the train and go back, go to the poorest part. She found an abandoned building and she started her order. I mean, she was just lovely. And then as she got up to go, I never called her by her name once. And I gave her my card with my name on it. And I said to her, as we stood up, I said, I'll never forget this day. And I gave her my card. And she smiled and turned to walk away. And I let her walk maybe 4 or 5 steps. And then I said, Agnes. And I thought, I've pushed this, you know. And she turned around. She had a smile on her face. And she said, it's been a long, long time since someone's called me by my name. And she still had my card. And she looked at it and she said, I too, Mark Peters, won't forget this day. Now, for me, I think she will always remember that journalist. Mm. From all the hundreds of other journalists, she'll remember that Mark Peters guy. Mm. And that's kind of like what I wanted to do.
Simply the best, huh?
Simply the best.
Yeah, at least. But the genocide, simply said, very, very special. Yeah, the courage or what do you do, or like this, just using the name. I think it's really, really a specialty or your special gift.
Well, you know, you get to live like that. We were in Mogadishu. I was with the American soldiers, Delta Force, which the Delta Force is the top of the army, like the SEALs and Navy. Mm-hmm. And basically, the SEALs run the army and the Air Force because they sail around. You can land a plane on there. You can carry the troops. So mm-hmm. But I was with Delta Force, and we were taking heavy fire in the squatter camp. And it's a weird noise because you hear the bullets go quack, 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 coming through the corrugated iron. And I looked up, and there was probably one of the best soldiers you get in the elite force like that is the medic. He was oblivious to the fire. He was about 50 yards away. And he was holding a saline drip and trying to take the soldier who had been shot in the shoulder. There was a lot of fire going on. And he was oblivious to all this. He was trying to take his uniform off. So I told the guys, hit more fire. And I just ran across this open ground and took the saline drip. And then he did his best, and then we patched him up. And then we both put our backs to the gunfire, and we ran him back again. And after the debriefing of that day, the colonel of Delta Force said, he called me up and he said, you know, this is Mark Peters. What he did today deserves a medal if it was under normal circumstances. But from to this moment onwards, you're an honorary member of Delta Force. And that was, but I didn't think that way.
Incredible.
Well,
that's it.
It was just to help that guy, you know.
You can't think about it. You need to live it. And then, you know. But before we keep on, just let's make a short another break.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
A for horses, B for mutton, C more cheeks, dig for victory. E bar gold.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle Magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better.
Marks and Spencer.
Add Health Triangle Magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com.
T for two.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
So before we go then there, and I think these honorable super soldier said, I want to ask a question with the films, at the time when you made the films, in the middle of whatever hectic situation, you needed to get the films out to London or New York.
That was always a mission.
And then there they could see the photo. You never saw the photo before.
It's a very good point you're mentioning.
How did you know it makes sense to send it, or you just need?
No, you know what's on that roll of film. You know, I mean, you photographed.
As a professional, you know.
You know what it is. Mm-hmm. But it's a very good point. I mean, many times I've been stuck on a bush runway, hoping that a medical plane will come in or a NGO plane will come in, and it's a Wednesday. I've got to get the film leased to Europe by Friday so we can put it on the Concorde to New York. That was always a tough one. I mean, today it's like satellites. A Penthouse magazine did a whole big thing on me, and it was called Shoot and Ship. basically, about how do you get your final product out. And the interesting thing is that every time I'd go back to New York, I'd go into the a quiet spot and I'd go through all my archives and my offcuts. And sometimes I'd just about have a tear in my eye, you know, because I remember that. You know, I remember that trying to save that person. And
yes.
I mean, I think I told you the story that I had in one day. I saved a little girl's life in a stampede. And the only reason I survived because I was an anthill. I did have a look at a little tree further on, but it had too much foliage. And it was at a border post, and the Hutus were coming through, and the Tutsis were attacking them with bombs and mortars. And it just cascaded down, and the people just panicked. And I don't know, there's a million people on the move, so you can imagine. But the day before that, I'd seen them, and I knew they were coming to the border. And I saw these women hitting a young girl with sticks. And I thought, this is not cool. So I got out the vehicle, and then I realized I took up some biscuits, and I threw them on the floor because I knew hunger would beat would stop them from doing that. But then as I walked up to the young girl, I knew straight away that smell of decaying death, human flesh. And she had a little red towel on her back, and she, probably her first baby, and she didn't want to get rid of it. But during that commotion, she managed to slip back into that sorrowful flow of people that were just heading to Nowhereville. So I just knew that they were going to be at the border post the next morning. And so I found myself a nice spot by the border post. The mortars came, the stampede ensued, and people around me and dust, they just squashed, dying. And I looked down, there were two little boys pulling their mother's arm, trying to wake the dead. And then I looked, where's the tree? The tree had gone. Then there was to be knocked over, and there's a stump, and there was this dead people and wounded people. And then there was this woman in a white dress, and she was waving to me. So I gingerly walked over dead, soft people, crying people, wounded people. And as I got near her, she lifted up her dress, and she had given birth to a little girl, still attached to the umbilical cord. So I picked her up and the baby, and I knew that if I walked to where my lodgings were, which is about a kilometer up, the night before I had a few drinks with the Red Cross guys, I anticipated the movement, and I knew they were going to be there. And it was on the guest house was on the same road. And I walked along, and then eventually my load was lifted by Red Cross guys. And then I heard a baby cry, and everyone was patting me on the back, and I'm saying, I was also in shock. I'm saying, it's not mine. And then I looked down, and there was this little baby yelling at life, born in a stampede, you know. It was a little girl. And then I went back to the guest house. I had a shower. I washed off the afterbirth and blood and dust. And then I realized it's only 9:30 in the morning. And then I fell asleep. And about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I went to the sliding door, the steel door of the walled-in compound that I was in. I asked the security guard to open it up. And yes, people were still marching by. And I stood watching them for a while. Then I went and had a beautiful rose garden. It was a lovely guest house, actually, in a situation like that. And I was sitting, I was going to write my notes. And then I saw the security guard come walking towards him with his hand over his mouth, and he was leading a little girl with a towel in her hand. And it was that little girl. She must have seen me there, just by fluke. And the security guard left her, and then she gave me her towel. And then I flipped it open, and there was this decayed body of a baby girl. With an army of ants moving from her mouth into her nostril, getting ready to do battle with the maggots in the open eyes. And the stench was unbelievable. So I put it down, and I took it to where the cleaning ladies were, and I asked them to take her into my room, wash her, clean her up. A new dress was needed, gave her a T-shirt of mine, and I went and booked another room next door to look after it till the Red Cross could come. Then I went back, and I'd asked the guy to get a shovel. And I came back, the shovel was next to the bundle. And then I just dug like a jackhammer out of control. And I went down about 4 feet in a rose bed. And then I buried the little baby. And then I put sand again. And then that night, while I was zigzagging my way through a bottle of whiskey at the bar, I started my notes. A day in the life of Rwanda. In the morning, I saved the little baby girl's life. And in the afternoon, I buried a little baby girl in a rose garden. End of story.
Yeah, but it's one part, but the babies, but there is war and killing and killing, and then there's births there also.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I went back to a refugee camp there for a couple of months to do a story on all the women that had been raped by the Hutus and the Tutsis. And these young girls didn't want these babies. And it was run by Spanish nuns. I mean, they're just absolute angels. They were living in those really hard conditions. And then one day, one of them called me over and she said, twins have been born. There were two little boys. And she said to me, name them. So I'm a little like, bam. So I wrote Kodak on the one and Fuji on the other. And the other day, I asked a friend of mine, Lindy Picard, and I was telling her the story. And she looked up Rwanda genocide, and she came across a guy. He's doing all these good stuff, and his name's Fuji. I mean, that must be that kid now, you know? Mm-hmm. So I'd love to actually go and find out if that is the guy that I named. You know? I mean, it'd be cool. But yeah, there's also good moments in life, you know. In the war situation.
The very tough situation, the war, and this is about life and death. But the other part is what is good and what is bad is a lot of our judgment. And I experience this coming from now living at the moment in Switzerland, kind of wealthy country, but I don't see so many really happy people. And when I was...
Yeah, my job was freedom to me. It was absolutely freedom.
People can be poor and so happy. And for you, freedom...
Freedom was so important to me. Absolutely.
And it's amazing.
I mean, we were in Mogadishu one time, just after Black Hawk went down. I was there when the pilot, I'm trying to think of his name now, was released. But I was in Nairobi and I flew back. There was a serious gun battle there. And... my drivers didn't know I was going to be there. And we were going to the Sahafi Hotel, and Sahafi means journalist in Arabic. And on the way there, we came to a roundabout called K Circle. And I was on the back of a truck and with a bunch of other people that weren't journalists. And we got ambushed. So we all dived into this ditch. There's a lot of gunfire going around. And I was this shallow ditch, and this guy next to me, he kept jumping up. I was so hot that I put my camera in front of me, and it's hoping that if I get hit, they'll take my cameras out. But this guy kept jumping up and down, and I looked to the left to see what was going on, and I looked back again, and he had been hit in the head, and he was lying there. I felt this liquid all over me, and then I looked, and he'd been shot in the head right next to me, and had blown the other side of his head out, and I could see the other guys. I was looking straight through his head. I could see everybody there. And then, you know, once that all calmed down, I got to the Sahafi and I sat in my bed, covered in brain matter and blood, opened a bottle of whiskey, and I just sat there and just, like, welcome back to Mogadishu, man. It's a hectically dangerous place.
You're also talking about a lot of wars in the past. Do you have the feeling that at least a little bit we developed and the world is a little bit, let's say, less war, and we are going in the right direction?
I don't know. I honestly don't know. You know, I've done so many wars in Africa, and then what happens? I go to the Balkan, and that was a big wake-up for me. And there's white people killing white people. You know, I was so used to black people killing black people. Israelis and Arabs going at each other. But when I was in the Balkans, that just was like, I was in Vukovar. I was probably the last journalist to get out of Vukovar. In fact, they made a movie about that. It's called Harrison's Roses. I was running away. The Serbs had come in, and they were shooting everybody. And I managed to get to the end of the city, and I ran through a mealie field, and they saw me down the bottom. But somebody told me just to turn right to the mealie field. And as I turned right, the bullets just went straight through. Then I ran onto a road. And I saw a car. I just stopped this car and I jumped in the car. And there were Serbs going to Belgrade. And that's not where I wanted to go. But I just wanted to get out of this. So I ended up in Belgrade and I couldn't get out of Belgrade. So nobody knew what would happen to me for 2 weeks. I still haven't paid that bill in Zagreb.
Is there for you any hope that we do better in the future?
I don't know. A
suggestion what we could do?
If I have one suggestion, that young men who go to war, the age limit by the United Nations or some treaty should be 21 is the youngest you can go to war. Mm-hmm. You know, you go to war and you see all these guys in Vietnam, 18 years old, 19, they don't know what the hell they're doing, man.
Yeah.
You know, the last thing you want to do is kids soldiers. Yeah. You know, you've got to, there should be an age limit if you go to frontline wars.
Yeah. So I have one more picture here that's coming, let's say, back around. It's another off your cover.
Yeah, that's
Mandela. Really sort of, we started with Mandela. Maybe we.
I love that picture because it's these traditional.
Yeah, what is this all about? Ready to rule.
Ready to rule the country.
He is now.
He's going to become president. Yeah.
And the Rainbow Nation. Yeah. Flag.
Yeah, I just like that picture of Mandela. It's just.
Yeah, smiling.
Yeah,
he did a great job.
Yeah, he did a great job, but he was. Yeah.
So there is possibilities. And, so we just need some more of those kind of leaders.
Yeah, unfortunately, it would have been great. I think Mandela wanted it. Ramaphosa could have come in after him, actually, to tell you the truth. But as a succession of line goes, it didn't work that way.
Yeah.
And I've still got a lot of confidence in Cyril Ramaphosa. Yeah.
Mark, thank you very, very much for sharing stories. Partly... Yeah,
I hope you enjoyed.
And we know it's partly, but I couldn't say enjoy is the right word to listen to you always. It's really extremely interesting. It's humbling. It's creating awareness and a lot of ahas. And somehow I would love that what you experience as a movie that every kid needs to go through it, yeah. That we are not so interested in war because we're, like you say, these agitated kids. They don't know what they're really doing.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and that's the whole system what we have. And that is what Winspiration is all about, to give you stories and insight that we understand that it's not about creating a better world. The world is perfect. It's us who mess up and that we can do better if we get more awareness about it, more consciousness. And if we do it right, we know the best is yet to come. Thank you for watching. Share it if you like. And stay tuned. And next week, we see us again. This was another episode of Winspiration, Wisdom and Information to support you getting out of illusions, false identifications, limiting beliefs. We all have the power and potential to be more, do more, have more, give more. Reality is what is possible in the universe. And the best is yet to come. If you want to dive deeper into possibilities of creating the extraordinary future, go to winspiration.global or to wolfgangsonnenburg.com. More information and some free downloads like the email program Dream Goals Reality or a copy of the book The Best Is Yet to Come can be found on the UK Health Radio website under the Listen on Demand and Presenters section. Join us again next week on the Winspiration Show for more wisdom and information to create your extraordinary future.